So we're calling for a mass immigration pause, not for 5 years, for 30 years. I think you have to have a good look at the whole society, try and find a new us, in other words. And I think if we don't do that, I'm not sure what sort of society we will be actually in by the sort of 2050s, 60s. We must do this.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, William Clouston, leader of the Social Democratic Party. William talks about the economic indifference that has gutted UK industry.
We need a type of economic nationalism which in British politics and American politics hasn't been around in the mainstream for a long time, but it will be, I promise you, because the public will demand it.
He shares his expectations for Britain's political landscape over the next few years.
I think, sadly for the British people, I think it'll get worse before it gets better politically. If you're a political opportunist, you'd say that's a good thing. I think it's terrible for the country.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders. I'm Lee Hall. Today it's a great pleasure to be sitting down with William Clouston, leader of the Social Democratic Party. William, thanks for coming in.
Thanks. Good to be here. Yeah.
So the SDP has been around for over 30 years. You're economically left-leaning, but also culturally traditional.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a bit more about the values of the SDP?
Yeah, it's. I mean, the history of the SDP is a long one. As you say, it goes back to 81. It's effectively a Labour Party breakaway. The Gang of Four split with it in the 80s. And it was very, very prominent in the 1980s. It still represents the biggest challenge to the two-party system in British political history. But after the 80s, it didn't break through, it didn't break the mould of British politics, change the system. So it sort of went back to the hinterlands a bit. And we started reviving it about 5 or 6 years ago, basically because there was a huge gap in the landscape of British politics, a massive gap. Politically, and we didn't fill it cynically. We didn't say, "Oh well, let's fill this." But what we believe, which is a party that's a little bit to the left on economics, but not aggressively so, just tries to have an active state that does the basics, utilities, railways, build some houses, does the things that the state should do, but which marries that with a cultural, traditional attitude, you know, faith, flag, and family. Some people call it respect for tradition, respect for our past. A patriotic party, but family is at the key of it. I mean, the disintegration of family life throughout the West, it's not just Britain, is the prime cause of social ills today, I think. And that's basically where we are. And interestingly, it's where about 55% of the British public are. So I'm very confident about the SDP long term. I think our main challenge is to get to become known. The more people know about us, the more they say, actually, that's what I believe. Mm. So, yeah.
How would success look over the next few years for the SDP?
I'm realistic. My members have to put up with me being realistic. I don't go around saying prepare for government. I think if you look at British political history, there have been four occasions where a party has been built pretty much from scratch and then becomes a properly national party. If you go on the Electoral Commission's website, you'll see about 350 parties. Most of them are very tiny. But on four occasions, a party's been set up and it's broken through. And the four occasions are Labour in 1902. It took them 20 years to get into government. But they had two critical advantages. They had a working class that was not represented. And they had a franchise that was being expanded. So they, with those two things, they were always going to break through. Because, as I say, the gap was there, you see. The gap was there and it needed to be filled. The second one was the post-war Liberals. After in 45, the Liberals had 65 candidates, had very little support. And Stewart and Joe Grimmond slowly built it back. So when Grimmond resigned in 68, I think it wasn't, Thorpe, an interesting character, an odd character, took over, but it became a national party again. It took 20 years. More recently, the Ecology Party that became the Green Party in the 70s. By the late 80s, it was nationally known. So people knew, is there a Green Party? Yes, and some people voted for them. I voted for them in the Euros in 88. haven't done that since. And then UKIP, which is a single-issue party, took 20 years. And a point Nigel Farage always makes is that you've got to build it before people use it. So those are the examples. And I think our model, our sort of political strategy vis-a-vis building the SDP is very much that. The reason I'm very confident about it is that, and I think I've said before, despite being very realistic about the attritional approach to building the party, the reason I'm confident is that I know that the gap is there, the huge political gap is there for a slightly left-leaning but patriotic party. And I know that the other parties can't fill it for various reasons. So I've predicted that in the 2030s, the SDP will have a massive party. I think that'll happen.
Before we dive into some of the policies, I just wanted to get your thoughts on how you think things will be over the next few years. Mm. It seems quite likely we will see a collapse of the Tories, Labour government get in. And if we look at Wales, it could be quite an eventful time. Yeah. How do you see the political landscape over the next few years?
I think, sadly for the British people, I think it'll get worse before it gets better politically. If you're a political opportunist, you'd say that's a good thing. I think it's terrible for the country. But I think Labour will, and we're talking at this point in time, there'll be an election in the next 12 months, there has to be. And I think Labour will win it. I think Starmer's strategy of saying nothing is the correct political strategy, but it betrays a complete dishonesty in the man. This is the man that tried to flip the biggest vote in political history in the referendum in 2016. Didn't want us to govern ourselves, and then, under advice, cynically, can't do a press conference without a British flag behind him now. Mm. So I've never been able to understand what he believes on economics. Perhaps he doesn't understand that. So I think what we will get is a Labour victory, probably quite a substantial one, although that's not, on the dynamics, that's not baked in. I'll explain why I think that's not the case. But so I think you'll get a Labour victory, and I think you'll get a form of government which is probably the worst combination you can have, which is a combination of neoliberal Blairist economics, which protects the status quo, you know, ultra-free trade, no protectionism, no idea that the country might protect its key national assets. And that combined with ultra-progressivism, which people call woke, I prefer progressivism or liberalism, runaway liberalism, socially. So that'll get worse. You're going to get a Racial Equality Act, which will bring in racial favoritism, and that'll increase antagonism on that issue. So it's the worst combination. So I, tragically, I think for the country, I think it'll get a lot worse under Labour. It's pretty bad under the Tories. It'll get a lot worse. And then late 20s, there'll be a massive opportunity for us to really project onto the national stage as a party that can change things. So I'm optimistic about our position in it, but I'm sad for the country because it will get worse.
Looking at some of the policies that are your kind of key interests, the first one being economic indifference.
Yes.
So you've said that the long-term social prosperity was sacrificed for short-term private gain.
Yes, yes.
And could you talk our viewers through how this age of indifference works?
Yeah, the best summary of it is the sort of bird's eye view of what happened in world trade. So China's introduction to the WTO gave rise to probably in human history the greatest raising out of poverty ever in terms of the number of people. So for China, its integration of the world economy has been a massive plus. The problem for the West is that the particularly skilled industrial workers and people involved in manufacturing and the towns that depended on that have paid a massive price for that. And the governments of all liberally minded countries, the United States here is the same, have been too indifferent to what is made where and by whom, even if it's slave labor, actually. And as a result, the quick description of it is that we've gutted the factories, we've closed the factories. We then have all the deaths of despair and social problems associated with that. We've replaced industrial jobs that were capable of being the foundation for communities and families. You remember, Lee, you could run a family on 40 hours of industrial work, a whole family of four on 40, we call it. And you couldn't do that now. And precarious jobs and call centers and delivery isn't an adequate substitution for a proper industrial job. And so a lot of things start to get worse, and the West starts to hollow out its industry. It starts to accumulate debt, because in trade terms, massively important, I think I'm the only politician that really talks about this a lot, trade, the cost of constantly running these massive trade deficits, which econ liberals of the right say don't matter. They again, it's indifference. They think it doesn't matter. And I'm making the point that it's actually not even economic theory I'm pointing out. I'm merely doing accountancy. I'm counting up how big your trade deficit is, and you can only pay for your imports in three ways. You can export something, you can sell something you've already produced, or you can issue debt. And we've done a lot of the last two. And that means at the end of each year, the United States and this country, it owns less and it owes more. And it really is as simple as that. We've been doing it for 30 years. So, the economics. The lack of... we also talk about rootedness and obligation and duty, because the industrialists, a lot of the industrialists that closed, managed these large corporations, closed down their factories, offshored the manufacturing to elsewhere, didn't really care about the country. These multinationals have very little attachment or obligation to the countries they're in. Chris Lash famously called them tourists in their own countries. And I think that's right. I think they, as long as they could see more short-term profit for them this year, they'd, you know, Middlesbrough or Philadelphia or Birmingham, doesn't matter where you are, close it down and face the consequences later. And again, a point I've made many times about sort of Thatcherite neoliberal economics on trade is that the costs, the aggregate costs of mopping up the blood from that in terms of social costs of these deindustrialized towns vastly exceeds the short-term benefits of running your economy like that. So if you, I mean, you know, because you'll have seen the figures, Lee, that some of our post-industrial towns now have economic inactivity rates among adults of 20%. Now, that is a consequence of just deindustrializing. You just don't, I mean, I always say it didn't used to be like that. And I think a lot of these things are coming to a head, so we need a serious rethink. We need a type of, not boneheaded, but we need a type of economic nationalism which in British politics and American politics hasn't been around in the mainstream for a long time, but it will be, I promise you, because the public will demand it.
One classic example would be nuclear. In the 50s, we were a world leader, and now we're trying to get other countries to help us with our nuclear power stations.
Yes.
And how is it justified to sell off so much of our key industry? It's like someone's taken the family jewels down to the pawn shop. I mean, why aren't people protesting about it?
I think it happens attritionally, Lee. I think the problem with a lot of this is it doesn't happen at once. So it's true, you're quite right that this was a country, a pioneer in the nuclear, civil nuclear industry in the 50s. And it was allowed to decline. And a part of that was an objection, an anti-nuclear objection that the Labour Party had, and then sort of indifference and ineptitude among the Tories. But we just didn't renew it. And in 2010, when the Tories got in, they closed down British nuclear fuels and deliberately. And it was only 4 years later they were going up to the Chinese and saying, could you build our plants? Now, I, as an economic nationalist, I would be against foreign states owning these key national assets anyway, because I think it's strategically foolish to have these important things under foreign control. It's just mad. Particularly when you can do it yourself if you want to. But I always say that a lot of these, I think the Tory party is absolutely culpable in this. I think they're maddening. I mean, I've got friends in the Tory party, but honestly, the number of times on immigration or housing or whatever that they've just done the opposite of what is conservative. I mean, it really is shockingly bad. And so this is a perfect example. You could have done it yourselves. You didn't want to. And shamelessly, you go to others to provide what you could provide for yourself. It's wrong.
As you mentioned, we've seen the dilapidated town centres. Mm. I mean, even here in Westminster, there's so many boarded up shops.
Yeah, yeah.
And was this a purposeful policy, or was it a catastrophic underestimation of what would happen if we put all our eggs into the services industry basket?
I think it's, I mean, some of that is the adaptation away from high street footfall towards online shopping is partly a consequence of just online.
Right.
Becoming, you know, just the march of that. It is easier. Consumers will, people, you know, people react to incentives. And if you can press a button, you know, and in 30 seconds order a book from Amazon, you will do it if it's too much. If you feel it's too much hassle to go downtown. And actually, if you look at the old footage of town centres in the 50s, 60s, 70s, bustling, absolutely bustling. So the whole the model has changed. So I wouldn't. But I mean, partly it is to do with an over-reliance on services, but I think probably town centres, that adaptation would have happened anyway. I think what we need to do is to consolidate high streets into more concentrated. You need more town centre management, actually, because most of them are overshopped. Some of the high streets, you know, have vacancy rates of 20-30%, as you say, and you know, if it's bad here, go to the northwest or the northeast in the towns that are really suffering. What you need is councils to actively concentrate. One of the things that would improve vitality and viability of town centres is actually more local shops, because it's a bit identikit. If you're in Exeter, it's too similar to Hexham, you know, the same chains.
Yeah, for sure.
So if they're managed, I think we can bring some of that back, actually. So I'm not too pessimistic about that.
Do you think the short-termism of our government, you know, the five-year cycle, plays a negative role in all of this?
It does, and it always has. If you read manifestos, post-war manifestos throughout, you know, particularly in the 50s and 60s, there's a complaint of the opposite. You know, the Labour Party will blame the Tories for short-termism. So it's a sort of ubiquitous problem. But yeah, it will cost you. Much any short-termers of the kind that we've had will cost you dearly in the long run. So you know, as I say, on running deficits or the reliance on debt, or another great example, a fine example now, is the failure to practice basic labour market planning. So I ask a question: the health service has a budget of 200 billion roughly. That budget is sufficient to train all of the clinicians, doctors, nurses, and ancillary staff that the health service needs. There can be no doubt about that. It is certainly sufficient to do it, but they don't do it. They don't do it because it's the policy not to do it, but it's easier simply just to click your fingers and import staff from the Philippines or Ghana or Nigeria or wherever. And that's a lazy short-term attitude. Which costs one for one a trained nurse in this country. And it's a classic example of it shouldn't happen, but it happens, and it's down to short-term attitudes.
One of your policy pledges is to renationalise the trains and the utilities. Mm. I mean, anyone who's got a train recently would agree something needs to be done.
Yes.
I'm sure there's a fair few of our viewers who are grimacing at the idea of more state control. I mean, how would you persuade them?
Well, it's funny, actually. It's a really important point that you bring up, because a lot of people really appreciate the SDP's strength on cultural issues. We're brave on cultural issues, and we'll say what's right, I think, for the country. And you know, standing up to progressives and liberal overreach and things, that's right. And then when we talk about the economics, some people say, I'm not sure about that. But let me try and make the case. On railways, for instance, remember that the state does the heavy lifting now, okay? So the track and the signalling and all the heavy lifting in terms of basic infrastructure is still state-run and state-funded and controlled. And that requires several billions to do that. What they've done is have a sort of phony privatisation, offering franchises on just particular tracks with different coloured trains. And it's not worked for lots of reasons. Firstly, you don't get integration. You know, you have a better system if you have the same company operating from Caithness to Sutherland, to Cornwall or whatever. You know, it's basic. The other thing is that the franchisees now can't make money. And what happens when they can't make money, say on the West Coast or the East Coast, famously? they give the franchise back and the state has to come in and do it. So we're not, we haven't actually ended up with a better system. It's a phony system. The biggest problem, I return to this, is that no self-respecting state would do this. And if you look at the franchise companies that run our railways, it's the Dutch National Railways, it's the German National Railways, the French National Railways, and the Italian National Railways. Now, the Italians and the Germans don't reciprocate. At the moment, they make some money out of some of these franchises and cart the money off back to Germany or France, which is bad for the balance of payments. Not a good idea. But from a national pride, can you imagine Peter Hitchens advocates a sort of British Gaullism? That's our type of politics. Can you imagine General de Gaulle saying, actually, I'd like the British to run our railways? It would be an insult. And I get a train, I work down here 2 days a week, but I live near Newcastle. And just as you get over the Tyne, quite often there's a locomotive there, a relief locomotive, and it's a Deutsche Bahn locomotive. And just beyond that track is Stevenson's boiler shop, which has made the first trains in the world. And we're very proud of it. And I can't see how you can't have, and it's not a big budget, Lee. This isn't, you're talking about 15 billion for the whole system, you know. So you're almost talking about tiny amounts in the national accounts. But why can't we have a national railway system which is an emblem of British engineering, management, and pride, liveried up with British rail claret, you know, on board? And I think that's what a sensible state does that cares about public realm and cares about what it does. And I think the people that see the country as a shop and not a home, the Tories, have done the opposite, and it's shameful.
One of the defining issues of our time is immigration. I'd like to know, you know, how you would approach that. What would you do about it?
Well, we talk about economics a lot, and we've talked, the End of Indifference economics paper that we did was basically about the problem of debt that we have. The first line of that in the introduction is that debt fuel consumption is not prosperity, and it isn't. Debt is one of our addictions. The other one is immigration. Mass immigration has become an addiction to this country because we can't be bothered to train our own people, and we can't be bothered to manage labour markets because we're marinated and accustomed to this open labour market. Partly that was a consequence of being in the single market, because again, logically, if you have 400 million people and you can have Svetlana, who is excellent, why train Sally? That was the issue. But we're not in that now. We're in a situation where we can take responsibility and end this constant. It is an addiction. And like any addict, the addict needs bigger hits. So immigration, you know, gross migration's gone up massively, 1.4 million now, probably. And net migration is at figures that are off the scale, probably 750 now, 750,000 people. This is an indicator that you have a major labour market problem. You have 5.5 million people, adults, on out of work benefits. We seem to have no plan to try and get our fellow citizens back into the workplace, and no incentive to do so. And yet we just ship in massive numbers of people. And I think the economic effects, which are the easy ones to talk about, it's much easier for me as a politician of the centre-left to talk about economics and the effect of migration economics. And it has three obvious effects: mass migration, lowers wages, disincentivizes training, and takes one job for job off a domestic potential employee. And those are easy, but those aren't, in reality, it's also the cultural question, which politicians will not talk about. Even those in the Conservative Party won't really face up to and address that if you import massive numbers of people from different parts of the world, you change the complexion and nature of your own society, you change its culture. And there is there's an absorption rate for immigration. How quickly could you absorb, how society can absorb from people from different places? Well, it's easier to absorb 10,000 than it is a million, obviously. And if you're totally indifferent to this sort of thing and you don't think it matters, your society will just become more divided and more atomized and balkanized. I think that's a terrible outcome. So again, it's another thing on the cultural side the SDP has been forthright on. So we're calling for a mass immigration pause, not for 5 years, for 30 years. I think you have to have a good look at the whole society, try and find a new us, in other words. And I think if we don't do that, I'm not sure what sort of society we will be actually in by the sort of 2050s, 60s. We must do this. So it's a
full generation. Pause.
Full generation, yes. Get back to necessary migration you will have for highly skilled people that you need, marriage union and so on. But with our addiction to this drug of mass migration is terrible culturally, and it's terrible economically, and it's got to stop.
We've had three successive governments now who have been elected on promises of doing something about immigration and not really doing much about it.
Yeah.
Why do they struggle so much to tackle it?
I think they're addicted to it. There are many causes of that, Lee. I think some of them are disingenuous. They don't really believe in it, don't want it. I think the Tory party is chock-a-block full of economic liberals. Liz Truss is a good example. She would have... this is the shop approach, you know, viewing the country as a shop and not a home. If Liz Truss felt that GDP would be up, increased by 0.5% if you had another 250,000 people, she'd just turn the tap on. She doesn't. These people have no conception of our country as a home or as a culture. They just don't understand it. I think that's part of the problem. I think the people in the Tory party that want stricter border control and lower migration are in the minority. And I think the Tory parties, you probably have to go back to Michael Howard to have a sincere leader on this. And, you know, obviously the loss of control of our national border on the southern coast, you know, the Channel migrants, chaos, is a massive current problem. And we're, you know, as a party, we support getting out of the ECHR and the post-war asylum protocols, which are totally outdated and not fit for purpose. And when we say that, people say, "Well, that's a bit, it's a bit harsh." Well, no, it was Tory party policy under Howard, and it was published in the 2005 manifesto. But then Cameron came in, and you just get back to the same old sort of Blairite liberal approach. Cameron's just Blair, really, and it's massively misaligned to mainstream opinion in this country. So mainstream opinion in this country wants lower migration, and all the polling says so. And I would say at the next election, my advice to the British public is, if the Tories say they'll reduce migration, don't believe them.
Matt Gilbin talked about the connection between affordable housing and immigration. I think the stat was nearly 50% of London social housing, the head of the household, was not born in Britain.
Yeah.
Do you think as a nation we don't really want to we're reluctant to face up to these issues, to talk about such issues?
Yes, there's a... It's partly a sort of it's partly politeness, I think, political politeness. I think a lot of politicians lack the vocabulary to talk about it in a good faith way. You know, my own family is mixed racially, and I have no problem at all talking about it. I think if you're a civic nationalist, you care about what this country does and what the outcomes are. It's totally illogical to have a view that. It's insane, actually, to think that 1.4 million gross migration won't affect housing. I'll give you the numbers. So in this country, the state sector capacity in building houses was basically deliberately destroyed, first under Thatcher and then absolutely destroyed under New Labour. New Labour, interesting stat this, people can't believe this, but it's true. New Labour built fewer council houses in the whole of its period in office than Mrs. Thatcher did every year.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
They destroyed it. New Labour destroyed state sector capacity in house building, and the coalition and the Tories have left it. So what we have is, it's like a bird with two wings. We have one sector, which is the private sector, building about between 160 and 200,000 units a year. And the state sector subsidises about 40 in the registered social landlord sector. But the state doesn't build at scale anymore. And so you've got an unbalanced, weak housing industry, and the state needs to get back in it big style. If you care about families, if you want kids to have a chance to pair up and start a family, which is a basic requirement of any state to provide, you've got to build some houses. But realistically, we would only build about 300,000 houses. You know, if we built 100,000 more, which is our policy, perhaps house of, you know, 2 million people in a term. You know, you've got to increase capacity by about a third, and you can't do overnight. You can't just do that. In any world, it's crazy if you care about housing to say we can build 200,000 houses and let 1.4 million people come in, and it doesn't matter where are people going to live. It's really, I mean, it's dishonest, and it's also innumerate. I mean, I think one of the problems is, and it's exactly what you say, Lee. People refrain from talking about difficult cultural issues over migration because they lack the vocabulary, and I think they lack the goodwill. And I think Shelter, the housing charity, refuse to engage with the issue, the fact that immigration must impact on housing. And that is just disingenuous. I mean, that is ludicrous for a housing charity not to realise that mass migration has got to impact on housing. People going to live in a tent? I mean, it's ridiculous. So we'll continue to bring it up, and you won't. It's one of these things that this is a primary cause of the housing crisis and a secondary cause. You might say mass immigration is the primary cause or the secondary cause. It doesn't really matter. Or the failure to build houses is the primary, whatever. But they're interlinked, and it's not honest to separate them. You've got to view any rational government would plan for housing with that in mind.
How much of a long-term project is it to fix the housing problem, would you say?
I think it's the right question to ask if you're serious, because I feel we do a lot on housing. We've done a lot of seminars, and we did a 2-hour-long seminar recently in the summer with Liam Halligan and someone from the IEA and Charlotte Gill. It was a good session. Detail, we like detail and try to get underneath it. And I feel sad when I speak to young people. If you're 20, if you're 25 or 30, I'm afraid the housing crisis is going to be solved in your period of your window opportunity to start a family. I think that's not for everyone. Even if you absolutely pull the stops out, and we've got a great plan to do it by taxing planning gain. It doesn't require any more taxation, general taxation, to do it. You can do it, but it will take time. I think if you take 30 years to get into a housing crisis, it could take 15 or 20 to get out, even if you really put your shoulder behind it. But if we carry on like this, we're going to have beds and sheds and chaos. And also, in the end, you're going to have strife, public strife over it. And I think it's irresponsible, reckless not to deal with it. But I have no real faith in either major party being honest about it. And by the way, Labour's proposals on housing are reasonable, better than the Tories in terms of construction. But unless they were serious about immigration, it's not going to achieve anything.
The final issue I wanted to ask you about is something you've mentioned several times in the interview already, which is the importance of family.
Mm.
In Britain has one of the highest levels of family instability in the Western world.
Yes.
How do we get to this point? What do we do about it?
We got to this point. I think most of the problem is cultural. I think most social scientists would trace it back to the flipping of a conservative mindset, attitudes, social norms, shame even, the replacement of that with individual rights and liberty and putting yourself first. And, you know, some people look at the divorce reform and things. But I think there's a very, very long tail to this. And I think, so that is, you know, the issue has not just suddenly emerged. You're quite right. the modern British 16-year-old is more likely to have a TV in their bedroom than a father in the house, which is a shocking statistic. And the sad thing about that is that if you look at outcomes, all the quantitative social science is on our side of the argument. Family stability matters massively, not just for the family concerned, the children and the parents, but the wider community and the whole of society. And on every single metric, family instability predicts worse outcomes for children in terms of health, education, mental illness, employment sustainability and criminality. And I'm afraid unless you're willing to be honest about it, about the importance of strong traditional model in married life and things, then I'm afraid you're not really contributing to the, you're part of the problem if you can't be honest about it. So I would, the first thing I would do is open a window for defense of married family life and family stability in cultural discourse, which is what we try and do. And I, you know, as I say, there's no, the facts are already on our side. What we need is better narratives, or better, stronger narratives rather, to make the case for it. But you also need stronger policies. And if you look across the policy spectrum, very, very few very strong pro-family policies in this country. I'll give you an example. If you were going to make a single tax reform that would help parents raising children, it would be full sharing of tax benefits between two parents. And that's an obvious gain. And you go to Leeds and you speak to young families, young mothers and fathers in a cafe, and they will tell you if that would make a big difference to our lives, and it would make raising the children easier. If you don't pay tax until you earn sort of £26,000 together, you have some space and time to actually raise your own children. The problem is now, the incentive is for, you know, one of the parents to work full-time, the other to work part-time, they're juggling, and then you have very, very expensive childcare. But actually, if we had very strong support for family life in this country, a lot of that wouldn't be necessary. So we'd get better outcomes. So you've got to do things like that. So support all of those in housing and tax policy as far as you can, any policy. But I think I've got to be honest, it is downstream of culture as well. And until we can, until people can accept that, we're not going to get anywhere.
Why are politicians so reluctant to talk about family breakdown, but also the benefits of stable married parents to children?
Cowardice, mainly, and the extent of backlash. I mean, even, I'm going to continue to make the case because it's true and it's necessary, but anyone that makes the case for stable married life, family life, will be criticised, and people will say you're demonising single parents. You are not at all. You're not. I mean, the pressure on single parents is colossal, and it's probably on a single outcome in your life. Becoming a single parent is probably the quickest route to poverty you can encounter. But I would just ask for a bit of honesty in it. Tony Sewell's excellent CRED report on racial inequality, which blew apart the false narrative of sort of wider structural racism narratives, which are, I would describe as conspiracy theories, really, a lot of them. They're not based on the quantitative science. If you look at disparities among different communities in Britain, obviously cultural attitudes are very important, but stability of marriage predicts a lot. Do you know, I'll give you some stats. So Raqib Hassan has brought out a wonderful book called Beyond Grievance, Criticism of the Left's Attitudes Towards Ethnic Minorities. And he points out in the book that take two communities on the end of the spectrum, black Caribbean children raised by single parents, about 60%+, the majority. British Hindus, 6%. And if you want to find out the importance of stable family backgrounds, look at the outcomes of the two communities. And when Rishi Sunak became Prime Minister, we looked at the British Hindu community a little more closely, and incredibly impressive, because you've got very high earnings on average, high savings rates, high family stability, and low encounters with the criminal justice system. I think there's 350 British Hindus in prison. And I think a lot of that is to do with family structure and family stability and giving children a stable environment. So the data says that. So we're just going to have to be honest, I'm afraid. And if people want to vote for people that don't have the courage to talk about this, they're welcome to. But if they want a proper alternative, then they should look at us, because we're going to continue to make the case that needs to be made.
Ian Clouston, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you. Cheers.